In the matter of Vincent Hager versus M&K Construction, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Matthew Gitterman, Bianca Mano, and DiStefano on behalf of the appellant M&K Construction.
Good morning, Justices Victor Matthews on behalf of the respondent Vincent Hager.
Good morning. Alan Silver from Pashman Stein Walder Hayden on behalf of the Amicus, the Coalition for Medical Marijuana of New Jersey, Doctors for Cannabis Regulation, and the National Association for the Reform of the Marijuana Laws, both the national organization and the New Jersey chapter.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Gitterman, please go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court. At first, I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal, maybe 2 minutes.
That's fine.
Thank you. In preparing to argue this morning, I was reading, obviously, cases on medical marijuana, and I'm not sure if Your Honors did read the case, but there's a recent case that was decided on October 27th by the Massachusetts Supreme Court. It's called Daniel Wright's case. The site of the case is SJC 12873. And honestly, I probably could not put it any better than the justices of the Massachusetts Supreme Court put it in their decision. With that said, they called the current legal landscape of medical marijuana law a hazy thicket. And I would certainly agree with them. Marijuana is obviously illegal under federal law. The Controlled Substances Act, CSA, classifies marijuana as a Schedule I drug. The CSA makes it a crime to knowingly or intentionally manufacture, distribute, or dispense, or possess with intent to manufacture, distribute, or dispense marijuana. The CSA makes it a crime to knowingly or intentionally possess a controlled substance. And it's clearly subject to criminal prosecution can be brought against a principal who commits the crime or any individual that aids or abets or willfully causes its commission. And I submit to Your Honors that by Judge Kovalchuk's order in this case, Judge Kovalchuk was the workers' compensation judge that the trial presided before, that Judge Kovalchuk's order essentially requires M&K Construction, if M&K Construction continues or actually follows the order, it would facilitate the commission of a crime. There's no difference whether M&K Construction or the insurance company for M&K Construction reimburses Mr. Hager for the medical marijuana, as opposed to if M&K or the insurance company were paying the dispensary directly. Whether the payment is direct or indirect, it's still, the payment is for marijuana, it's knowingly for marijuana, and as a result, it's a crime. When I appeared before the appellate division, found against us and relied on the completed crime doctrine. And basically, they found that by paying for the marijuana after the fact, that M&K would not be aiding or abetting the commission of a crime. While I certainly agree with them that you cannot aid or abet a completed crime, I respectfully disagree with their analysis of this particular situation. A promise of future reimbursement in and of itself assists in the act of committing the crime. The promise encourages a future act. In this particular instance, M&K would be asked to continue to pay Mr. Hager and reimburse Mr. Hager over and over and over again for his purchases of marijuana. Therefore, it is not a completed crime, and it's an ongoing crime. And as a result of that, I respectfully submit that the appellate division's reasoning was faulty in this case. Regardless of how prosecutors exercise enforcement discretion, they can't change what federal law is. Federal law is that marijuana is illegal. And because of that, the order of Judge Kovalchuk creates a situation where M&K is asked to violate federal law. And I certainly recognize that New Jersey just ratified, you know, marijuana through a ballot. And I certainly recognize that the Medical Marijuana Act is law. But indicated in the Massachusetts decision, the language in the Medical Marijuana Act, and specifically on page 10 of the Massachusetts decision, they quote New Jersey's Medical Marijuana Act, and they quote the language in the act, and indicate that while certainly Mr. Hager can decide to use medical marijuana under the New Jersey Act, Mr. Hager is subjecting himself to the possibility of federal prosecution. And while Mr. Hager can certainly make that decision to subject himself to that criminal prosecution, it's improper for Judge Kovalchuk to require M&K Construction to subject themselves to criminal prosecution.
Mr. Gitterman, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
Aiding and abetting is a specific intent crime. If an employer is making a payment because a court has ordered the employer to do so, does that employer have the necessary intent to be an aider and abettor?
I believe that it does. I believe that it does, Your Honor. I believe that by knowingly making a payment that's reimbursing Mr. Hager for Nana, that constitutes the crime of aiding and abetting Mr. Hager in his efforts to secure the marijuana. That's really the subject of my argument today. I would also just like to add that I'm a workers' compensation attorney. My clients regularly provide injured workers with medical treatment. And in all my years of doing this, my clients always pay the providers directly. By Judge Kovalchuk asking M&K to reimburse Mr. Hager for the marijuana, obviously Judge Kovalchuk recognized that M&K could not pay the dispensary because that creates other problems. And it just goes to show that this is not, legal federally. Yes, it's legal under the New Jersey Medical Marijuana Act, but it creates a situation where there's a conflict clause, a preemption conflict, and under the Supremacy Clause, New Jersey really can't require M&K and its insurance company to provide Mr. Hager with reimbursement for medical marijuana. I also want to add that
Mr.
company in this case is Pennsylvania National Insurance Company. They're headquartered in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. They're licensed to do business in New Jersey for workers' compensation purposes. And again, if they send a check from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania to Mr. Hager in New Jersey, that check crosses state lines and clearly could implicate them in a federal
crime. Mr. Gitterman, Mr. Gitterman, we're dealing with conflict preemption, correct? So we know that there are many states now that have medical marijuana laws. And we also know that there are many states that have passed laws permitting the use of recreational marijuana, correct? Correct?
Correct. I'm sorry, you're breaking up on my feed, but yes, correct.
You've been breaking up on, I think, on our feed as well. My apologies. Are you aware of any effort by the Department of Justice to prosecute anyone in any jurisdiction where medical marijuana is lawful, and now where the use of recreational marijuana is lawful. Are you aware of any?
I am not, Judge. I am not. But respectfully, I would submit to Your Honor that's irrelevant because...
Okay. Well, that leads to my question about conflict preemption. I'm just trying to set it up. So it's clear that if we lay the CSA right next to the law, there's a conflict in the written. Does it make a difference that there doesn't seem to be any realistic possibility, likelihood, based upon experience and what we know is going on around the country, that the federal government has any intention of prosecuting any of these cases? And in answering that question, take into consideration also the Rohrabacher Amendment, in which the federal government has not funded Department of Justice money to prosecute any of these cases. I mean, should we take all of that into consideration in determining whether or not conflict preemption applies in this case?
I don't think we can pick and choose what laws to follow and what laws not to follow. I understand what you're saying about the federal government has not prosecuted marijuana. However, under the most recent memorandum pertaining to the issue issued by Mr. Sessions, he reserved the right to prosecute. So I respectfully submit that it is irrelevant whether the federal government has prosecuted or whether we think they're going to prosecute going forward. The fact is that medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, violates the CSA and does create federal crime.
So Mr. Gitterman, I take it from your response to Justice Albin that you see no practicality aspect or element to the conflict analysis that this court should engage in. Because that is the heart of what Justice Albin is getting to. With the Appropriations Act activity, and the lack of any steps taken to bring federal prosecutions, are we to ignore the practical knowledge that we can glean from that information that there is in fact no conflict by New Jersey enforcing its medical marijuana law?
I mean, conflict preemption in and of itself doesn't look to whether the federal government, you know, has or will prosecute. The fact is there's a conflict in the laws. And by requiring an employer in New Jersey to violate that law, whether the federal government, you know, I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. And, I was thinking about this because I knew Your Honors were going to ask me this question. And I was thinking about this. I mean, think about this. I mean, 30 years ago, or whenever opioids came forward, everyone thought that opioids were great. They were, they were phenomenal. Right now, all of the studies that are being done on marijuana are obviously not permitted to be FDA approved. Obviously, because it's a it's a drug, an illegal drug under the CSA. The studies that are, for the most part, the studies that are being done are all being done by the marijuana industry. There are a few studies. There was an article in October in the New York Times that cited to a study in a medical journal that talked about how, medical marijuana and specifically smoking medical marijuana can have a fivefold effect of causing heart attacks as opposed to just smoking cigarettes. It can cause lung cancer. Suppose,
we're not here to argue the merits of a policy that has been adopted by the people of New Jersey by constitutional amendment and acted upon by the New Jersey legislature. So let's go back to the question of this case, which is whether or not your client is at risk, as you say, of federal prosecution, because that is the crux of your defense to this workers' comp judgment. I want to follow up on a question that the Chief Justice has asked you with regard to aiding and abetting being a specific intent crime. The New Jersey law, and I want to focus on New Jersey law, has said that health insurers are not required to comply with the medical marijuana law. Another is essentially the Medicaid program. So the state has not required Medicaid to reimburse for medical marijuana, and it's not requiring health insurers to enter into first party contracts with individuals who wish to purchase health insurance to provide coverage for health benefits that include needing to take medical marijuana. But what we have here, and what the Chief Justice's questions sparked for me, is that you're a third party situation. Workers' comp is paying on a judgment. You're a third party payer, not a first party payer. So you don't fit within anything that has to do with health insurer. You're simply playing on a judgment that your client, the employer of Mr. Hager, owes to provide medical benefits as a result of Mr. Hager's injuries. So how do you fit into a specific intent to aid and abet when you're in that situation? I see it as removed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's clear. I mean, the Massachusetts Supreme Court adopted it. The Maine Supreme Court adopted similar findings.
And so have other courts gone the other way.
New Mexico has gone the other way. Right now, I'm only aware of three Supreme Court decisions throughout the country. New Mexico, found against me. Maine and Massachusetts found for me. But I submit to your honor that, there is no question in my mind that paying Hager, reimbursing him specifically the amount that he tells them he's paying or receipts, that they are abetting and aiding the commission of a crime.
By saying that doesn't make it so. I'm having a difficult time understanding how paying on a judgment, essentially a tort judgment, because the workers' comp system replaces the need to bring a tort action in superior court, by paying on a tort judgment, that somehow you are aiding and abetting.
I mean, you're still paying for marijuana.
So you're reimbursing.
Going to a court judgment or not.
Well,
really irrelevant if there's a federal prosecution, and there could be a federal prosecution. You're violating federal law. We can't choose.
Your client essentially wants to be freed of its judgment obligation here, correct?
I'm sorry?
So your client simply wants to be freed up of his judgment obligation.
My client is certainly willing to provide Mr. Hager with appropriate medical treatment, and has offered to provide Mr. Hager with pain management treatment, to which he has not availed himself.
That argument in workers' comp.
I'm sorry?
You lost that argument in workers' comp. The alternative medical plan that you were proposing.
The judge ordered medical marijuana. That's what I lost. But I'm submitting to you, by paying for marijuana, by paying Mr. Hager, they are committing a crime. There's no question about it.
There's a big question since that's what's before this court.
Mr. Gitterman, going back to the aiding and abetting, can someone be found guilty of aiding and abetting if they have a bayonet at their back to do something? Someone has a bayonet at someone's back and they're told, do this. Do you think that's an aider and abetter?
If they have a bayonet, you mean pointed at their back or just holding it?
Yeah, someone has a bayonet at their back and they're told, this is what I want you to do. Is that person aiding and abetting?
Obviously that person would have a defense they're obviously acting to preserve their own life.
Okay, I'm using that as a metaphor. I mean, is an order from the court from the workers' comp court, and then from the appellate division any different than a bayonet at someone's back?
No, but let me ask you this. I understand your point, and it's a valid point, but as I sit here today, if any of you justices were in my position, could you advise your client that they will not be prosecuted federally and legitimately advise them that? I mean, anything could happen. A week from now, there could be a run on, you know, people dying from marijuana, and all of a sudden the federal government would decide, you know what, we're going to start prosecuting.
You asked me a question. Let me throw it back at you.
Sure.
Do you think that there's any realistic possibility, and I'm just going to say hypothetically now, because I don't know what this court's going to decide, but assume that this court said that it was lawful for you to reimburse. Do you think that there's any realistic possibility that any federal court would ever uphold a conviction against your client?
First of all, I think it's irrelevant. But second of all, I do think that's possible. Okay. But they're still violating the law.
Mr. Gitterman, I have a question for you about the reimbursement, which is not the conventional manner in which payments are made. Is that reimbursement consistent with the Workers' Compensation Act in terms of the types of benefits, the medical benefits? Presumably there's an award of medical benefits here. Does the Workers' Compensation Act require direct payment, or is reimbursement within the scope of what's allowed?
You know, the answer is yes, but to really give the question justice, I would submit to Your Honor that when I read the Massachusetts case, I actually looked at the Massachusetts law, and they have a lot of regulations about how employers or insurance companies are to make payments to medical providers. New Jersey does not have specific guidelines in the statute or in the administrative code as to how those payments are to be made. Obviously, there are guidelines as to what is to be paid, reasonable, necessary. But in answer to your question, yes, with a caveat that, you know, for the most part, it is not done that way. For the most part, my clients, insurance companies, self-insured employers, pay providers directly, pay for medications directly, and generally do not reimburse claimants for treatment.
I just have one follow-up. For the most part, workers' compensation medical benefits are provided without a court order. They're provided even before the court rules, correct?
Correct.
So to the extent that your client in this specific situation has the benefit of a court order, benefit from the point of view of the aiding and abetting issue, it's really an unusual setting, is it not? Insofar as generally what workers' compensation providers do is try to get the medical payments going quickly, consistent with the act, and doing that without a court order specifically ordering that amount to be paid. Am I right about that?
You're right about that.
So to the extent there's a bayonet, to use Justice Albin's analogy, and we always rely on Justice Albin for the most colorful analogies, to the extent that there's a bayonet at issue in this case, we don't have that in most settings where employers would be faced with this situation. Am I correct?
That is correct. That is correct. But again, I would submit to Your Honors that it's irrelevant. A court order is not going to be a defense to a federal prosecution.
Well, can you be certain about that? Since aiding and abetting requires that a defendant have a purpose to act, if you have a court order, you don't have any, your state of mind, the defendant's state of mind, doesn't come into play. You're being told what to do. The aiding and abetting presumes that the actor is acting volitionally. When you have a court order compelling you to do something, you're not acting volitionally. You're acting in accordance with the court order. Am I mistaken about this?
I mean, you're not mistaken. You're acting in accordance with the court order, but you're knowingly reimbursing Mr. Hager for marijuana, and you're committing a crime.
We do feel more comfortable if our opinion said you're not subject to federal prosecution because we order you to do this. Would you feel more comfortable then? Would you feel more comfortable if that opinion went whatever way it went and you lost, if the opinion said you're not subject to federal prosecution because this court is ordering you to make the payments?
Would that make I all due respect for your honors and for the New Jersey Supreme Court, but I don't think that, your honors have the ability to insulate my client from a federal prosecution if that occurs, or any employer or any insurance company from a federal prosecution if that occurs.
It was really a rhetorical question, Cass.
Thank you, Judge.
You have to unmute, Chief.
Thank you. You can't be insulated from the prosecution, but you're in the position of standing in front of the jury and saying, at every possible turn, we fought against this. We didn't want to do this. We're here because the court said so. You think you get convicted?
I'm sorry, you broke up at the very end.
Do you believe that with that backdrop, there's a conviction that awaits you from the jury?
I mean, I'm not a criminal attorney, Judge, but I don't even want to be charged. I don't want my clients to be charged in a federal prosecution. And again, we cannot pick what laws to obey and what laws not to obey. It's a federal law. If we want to do something, we should ask our senators and our congressmen to change the status of marijuana federally. It's still a crime.
Understood.
I would not want to be in that situation to be federally prosecuted.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add at this point, Mr. Gitterman?
Nothing at this point, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Justices. 10 years ago, New Jersey enacted its medical marijuana statute. And in that 10 years, New Jersey health statistics show that we have over 50,000 enrollees in this program. And of those, almost 30% are receiving medical marijuana for chronic musculoskeletal injuries. So it was only inevitable that we were going to come to this crossroads where we were going to face this question as to whether a workers' compensation judge can order an employer to reimburse an employee for the cost of medical marijuana that is prescribed for his chronic pain following a work injury. And I bring that out because at the time of this trial, Mr. Hager had been enrolled in the medical marijuana program for 2 years. He was expending over $600 a month for medical marijuana. And the cost has not been reduced since then. And his maximum rate of compensation in his award was $301 per week based on his wages. I don't need to do a significant budget analysis to show you that the value of this judgment for him is significant in many, many ways. And if I can frame my argument three ways, the first point I'd like to make is that our workers' compensation statute specifically makes provision to provide reasonable, medically necessary treatment to alleviate an injured worker from their injuries that they sustained. And there's no question the proofs in this case establish that Mr. Hager utilized various modalities, two surgeries, other modalities, chronic opioid usage, and ultimately came to turn to what our legislature has deemed a compassionate form of treatment, which is the use of medical marijuana. And it's not only appropriate in this case to deem it to be reasonable and necessary under our statute, But is it also significant when you factor in the duration of his symptoms and the reality that the prior modalities of care that he employed, such as opioid usage, now require a patient to obtain a Narcan prescription so they can explain to their family and friends how to revive them when the inevitable happens, that their body gives out because of the opioid usage or they overdose. So I don't think there was any question that this is appropriate modality of treatment to employ for an individual who suffers a work-related injury. But then we turn to the actual statute itself and the language contained therein. And the appellant wants to frame its argument that they are somehow excluded by the provisions of this statute, which discuss the fact that a government medical assistance program or a private health insurer are not responsible for reimbursement. And I would put to you, just as Justice LaVecchia pointed out, workers' compensation, employers, carriers are not government medical system programs. So it really turns on whether they are private health insurers. And when we look at that, there is no definition in our Medical Marijuana Act. However, we have to look elsewhere, and we find in Title 17B a definition of health insurer, which specifically excludes workers' compensation coverage. And furthermore, we look at the language of our Medical Marijuana Act, which talks in terms of private health insurers. We permit in New Jersey under the Workers' Compensation Act for an employer to be self-insured. We have public entities such as the state of New Jersey, which are self-insured for workers' compensation coverage. There's no private to that. The other point I'd like to make about the statute is it states we are excluding these two entities, medical assistance programs and private health insurers, from reimbursement. So the legislature clearly contemplated there would be reimbursement in some instances for medical marijuana. And these were the only two entities that were to be excluded. And there had to be a motivation and a reason. And I put to you that, just as been discussed already, that the Controlled Substance Act schedules marijuana as a drug that the FDA, Food Drug Administration, cannot research, cannot recommend as a prescribed drug. And what is contained in every government medical assistance program and private health insurance policy, a prescription drug rider or prescription drug coverage, marijuana is not a prescribed drug. Its usage is certified and authorized for qualified patients under specific medical conditions, which we have delineated under our statute. So there's a clear explanation as to why our statute was written that way. And it clearly could have been written differently. It could have discussed any health insurer, such as Massachusetts did, or it could have been similar to Ohio or Florida, which expressly excluded workers' compensation carriers from responsibility for reimbursement. But our legislature chose not to. And that is very significant because they contemplated just what we are faced with today. And then ultimately, we move to the issue which we all have to wrestle with. There is no question that the Controlled Substance Act preempts all state law. However, they specifically at Congress addressed the reality that they would not be seeking to, if in effect, intervene in state law unless a positive conflict existed between state law and the Controlled Substance Act. So that is the conflict that we look to here. And the appellate court addressed it. I attempted to argue it. I think successfully we have raised the point that at this point, there is no positive conflict in as much as the mere act of reimbursement does not require possession. It certainly does not require distribution or manufacture on the part of the workers' compensation carrier or, more importantly, the employer. And ultimately, when you look at the situation from that perspective, you see that there is no positive conflict, in particular when you step back and realize that Congress since 2014 has appropriated no funds to the Department of Justice to interfere in medical marijuana legislation throughout the United States. And at this point, we have 33 states. We have District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, all that have some form of medical marijuana legislation in place. In this instance, we also have a state, the state of New Mexico, which has gone as far to codify and essentially create rules and regulations which compel workers' compensation carriers to, if you will, provide reimbursement for medical marijuana. There's been no federal prosecution, no congressional action against New Mexico. Their statute has been in effect since 2016. We turn to this issue of aiding and abetting, and I know many questions have already been brought out about it. Clearly, the carrier in this instance is not being put in any position to advance the crime. They are doing so, as the justices have all pointed out, by court order. But equal significance, they are doing so in a manner that in which they do not take the affirmative control over the possession, the manufacture, or the distribution. They do not do so. And in effect, in this particular instance, when it comes to the act of aiding and abetting, there's no question the event has occurred when they pay. And Justice Patterson, to answer your question more specifically, there are a number of instances where reimbursement is the appropriate form of payment. For example, a paraplegic that incurs the medical necessity for a handicapped vehicle or modifications to their home. Oftentimes those costs are incurred and then reimbursed because workers' compensation carriers are not in the business of home modification as a trade. So that's not as uncommon as you would think. And many times in litigated matters in which there is a dispute, ultimately the treatment being provided and the petitioner entitled to reimbursement for the cost of same. So it is not an uncommon practice within the division.
Is there a distinction, Mr. Matthews, between a court-ordered reimbursement and a voluntary provision of medical benefits, whether by reimbursement or by direct payment to the providers, for purposes of the question as to the interface with federal law?
I think you raised the point that was raised in Massachusetts ultimately, was the fact that we're trying to avoid litigation. So are we going to litigate every medical marijuana case so the court has to enter an order to compel the carrier to protect them and insulate them? Or if the carrier voluntarily steps up and says, okay, it's appropriate, I will provide the benefit, have they now created a greater exposure for themselves?
Yeah, and obviously our Workers' Compensation Act, as apparently is analogous to what Massachusetts has, really fosters voluntary payments and quick payments so that the individual is not waiting.
All right, so I will bring this observation to you if I can answer your question. It is not uncommon now for an authorized physician, pain management physician, to recommend medical marijuana for an injured worker, because they reach the point there are other modalities of treatment. It's also not as uncommon as you might think for certain entities such as the state of New Jersey and other carriers to provide that benefit, because they do not fear prosecution from this particular exercise. And they recognize that their authorized doctor has recommended it.
Understood, but is there a distinction in terms of a potential defense of duress, I guess, to an aiding and abetting prosecution, theoretical, but possible? I think everybody concedes it's possible to have an administration that simply wants to go in a different direction.
Sure,
Between a voluntary reimbursement or provision, direct provision to the providers, and a litigated matter, which sometimes happens in workers' compensation, but is not favored by the law, which results in a court order.
I think my argument would be that any effective crime has been completed. I am providing a payment. I am not in any way if you will, advancing a crime. And I am complying with a statute in the state of New Jersey, which requires me to provide medically necessary modalities of care to a patient. Because the alternative would be that I would be leaving the patient without a mode of care.
And you've just articulated defense that would be provided, but is there a distinction between the two, is what I'm saying, between the court order and the voluntary reimbursement?
I think there has to be a distinction. I don't think you can avoid saying there's not a distinction. But I think the same rules would ultimately apply for in terms of defenses and protections for the carrier.
Mr. Matthews?
Yes.
In response to that, does that tie into the question that I was asking earlier? The workers' comp system has replaced tort litigation for injured workers. Employers have an obligation to provide medically necessary treatment.
Yes.
With or without an order from a workers' comp judge, because of the structure of our legislation.
Correct.
So can that provide the sufficient differentiation in this situation?
I think so. I think that's accurate. I think that's accurate. And I also think it's accurate that you referenced tort litigation, because in a civil matter, if my client incurred damages, which included the cost of procuring medical marijuana, why would I be prohibited from presenting to a jury the argument that those damages are costs are reimbursable as damages?
Precisely.
Mr. Matthews, would it make a difference if an employer were required to pay the money up front in terms of an aiding and abetting theory and a violation of the CSA?
You know, I think it makes a difference, but I don't think it changes ultimately the defenses that exist. But I think it clearly does make somewhat of a difference. I don't think you can say not. And I think our medical marijuana statute discusses reimbursement expressly for that reason, rather than some other modality of authorization and paying.
So what's the meaningful difference between that situation and a guaranteed reimbursement?
You mean in terms of the practicality of it, or in terms of legally, in terms of the defense related to aiding and abetting?
Legally, under the aiding and abetting theory.
Yeah. Well, I ultimately believe that when you are ordered to reimburse, I think we've made clear that we see the protection there. If on the other hand, you're voluntarily providing a benefit that a statute requires, and this is both the Compensation Act and the Medical Marijuana Act in this state, I do not know, in my mind, I do not see where you would be put in a greater likelihood of being convicted of aiding and abetting there, because effectively, as I stated, you're agreeing to be responsible for the entire liability as it's construed under the Workers' Compensation Act. And the statute says that in Section 87. That's what it calls workers' compensation coverage. So you're being put in that position where it is your ultimate responsibility to provide that.
Yeah, Mr. Matthews, once a court such as the Appellate Division, which has statewide jurisdiction, says that the statute is enforceable, then the position is no longer voluntary. It's not necessary for every workers' compensation judge to enter an order.
I don't believe so. I don't believe so either, Justice.
Statewide jurisdiction passes on the enforceability of the statute. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I do. I think that's the practical effect if this decision is favorable to my client.
Other questions, anyone?
Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Matthews?
No, thank you, Justice.
Thank you. Mr. Silber.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Justice. I thought it might be useful first to talk about the federal statutes, because 841A is not implicated here at all. That statute only prohibits production, distribution, and possession with intent. It does not speak to the crime that is being talked about here, which is simple possession. That statute is 21 U.S.C. 844, and it makes it unlawful to possess any controlled dangerous substance. And these are interesting words, unless such substance was obtained directly, comma, or pursuant to a valid prescription or order from a practitioner while acting in the course of his professional practice. And I think it's also important in terms of the points that Justice Alvin made and Justice Lavecchia made and the chief made about the practicality. That statute carries a maximum penalty of 1 year in jail and $1,000 fine, which, as you know, is paltry compared to all of the other punishments for violations of the CSA. So in terms of practicality that was being discussed, for a U.S. attorney to try and indict an employer or an insurance company for reimbursing somebody for pursuant to a court order for a statute that, truthfully, I'm not so sure from the language of the statute that there's a crime. I mean, that's really pretty interesting language. I really just looked at it for the first time because, as most criminal practitioners in the federal world know, and I know the Chief Justice knows, that statute is not really prosecuted very often in federal court, maybe in the Fort Dix kind of cases. But the U.S. Attorney's Office is not really prosecuting 844 cases. Those cases are reserved for favorable plea agreements for defendants. So if we're really talking about the practicality of a federal government prosecuting the insurance company or the employer for reimbursing $616 for the months of cannabis medical cannabis use, there's no chance that that's going to happen. That's not even a long...
Mr. Silber, you've given us 2 points there, and I think there's a distinction between the two. One is you're saying that the elements of this offense would not be potentially, you're arguing potentially might not be provable by the federal government. But on the other hand, you say that only a year in jail and only $1,000 makes it pretty minor. That the extent of the potential punishment has no bearing on the conflict preemption issue, does it?
May I dispute that? I think it does, because when we're talking about the practicality, which is what Justice Alvin produced and Justice Lavecchia, we're talking about the practicality. You don't take an unusual case, as we pointed out, none ever has happened in the United States from 1996, where the first Medical Cannabis Act takes place in California, and up to the present time, it's never happened. And the idea that it would happen for a statute that is so benign, I think, does speak very eloquently to the lack of practicality here and the fact that it's never going to happen. The second item, and you correctly saw, is I'm not sure that there's a conflict. I mean, what does that language mean? If we go back to the history of medical cannabis in the United States.
Can you read that statute again? You're reading a federal statute?
I am reading a federal statute.
Give us the statute again and the number slowly and then read it again, please.
I will do my best, Judge.
Thank you.
Okay, it's 21 U.S.C. 844. And it provides that it shall be unlawful to possess controlled dangerous substance unless such substance was obtained directly or pursuant to a valid prescription or order from a practitioner while acting in the course of his professional practice. And then later on in the statute provides the maximum sentence of 1 year and the maximum of $1,000.
Silber, I have the statute in front of me that you're reading from. And I mean, clearly it's talking about the entire schedule of drugs that the federal government promulgates. And many of those below Schedule 1 are permissible for use in connection with a valid prescription. Do you think this language can override the Schedule 1 prohibition that finds no permissible medical prescription can be issued for the items that are listed in that one, like marijuana, unlike opiates?
as a criminal defense lawyer, I feel pretty confident with that language. I'm not sure what it means. I'm not telling you that I have an absolute knowledge what it means, but it sure changes the equation from what we were talking about with 841.
Creates some ambiguity when you read it in combination with the other section that identifies what a Schedule I drug means.
And certainly that's relevant to conflict preemption, the ambiguity in the statute, and it's relevant to the expectation. I mean, you know, truthfully, we don't have really the possibility of this employer being prosecuted for, you know, aiding and abetting. I mean, the employer actually faces no danger. So the conflict isn't there. And maybe I can respond just one moment to what the initial talk about the Massachusetts statute, the Massachusetts case that was decided October 27th, Wright versus Central Insurance. That case actually has no application to this case. And the reason I say that is that case is decided on the conflict within the Massachusetts statute, which is alleged here, which is the language in the New Jersey statute is 24-6I-14. There's an analogous word-for-word provision in the Massachusetts statute. It's word-for-word with the 2017 version of our statute, which was amended in 2019, but language was added. The same first sentence is word-for-word. And frankly, that's the Massachusetts case parts from this case because the linchpin is private insurers are accepted. What do private insurers do? They sell insurance. We define insurance in the statute that Mr. Matthews pointed out to 17B 17.4, and that specifically says that workman's compensation is not part of private health insurance. So it's clear that the Massachusetts case is completely distinguishable from our statute by 17B, 17.4.
Mr. Silber, what was the legislature's goal in excluding or essentially not requiring insurers to provide the benefits? Was it protecting insurers? Was it trying to protect insurers from potential legal peril?
It has that effect, but I don't think that was the motivating factor. If you read the literature, because almost every state that enacted medical marijuana has something like that in there. And the reason really was to avoid the conflict with federal government. And that's
so there we have it. You know, there's a legislative recognition of a problem here. And I know there's a statutory interpretation issue as to whether comp is in that category or not. I'm not addressing that, but there was a legislative recognition that insurers may have a potential legal peril, and we're therefore going to just not require them to play ball on this.
Right. I'm not understanding what you meant when you said there may be some kind of problem. 17B clearly answers.
No, I'm sorry. I must have said it unclearly. Wasn't the legislature trying to, and trying to avoid a situation where an insurer could view itself or potentially be in some sort of legal peril?
Granting that, it's
the answer is yes, right? That was the answer.
Yes, but not workers' compensation coverage.
Understand. And I'm not getting to that issue, but it does reflect the legislature's view that this is a difficult area.
I think. Every legislature, all 33 that have passed medical cannabis bills, are understanding that the federal prohibition creates problems for medical cannabis. And so the various legislatures did their best to walk through the tulips. And I think the exclusion of governmental agencies and private health insurance from being compelled to reimburse is part of that walking through. But in the case here at bar and for the question that was certified by this court, I don't understand why that, I mean, it's true, but why is it relevant? Because we have this clear exception for workers' compensation coverage.
Mr. Silber, two questions. One is to follow up to your interesting argument about Section 844. Have other jurisdictions
addressed that
in the reported decisions?
No, let's put it this way. What reported decisions? Certainly the main course, doesn't talk about, the Maine case doesn't talk about it at all. And may I say, you know, since Maine is persuasive, not binding authority, the dissenting opinions in that case are really brilliant. Justice Jabbar really puts the point that should be this court's majority opinion. And really interestingly, Justice Alexander, in a very short dissenting opinion afterwards, talks about it from the standpoint of the person we're really supposed to be helping, the worker, the person covered. So are we really, from a policy standpoint, going to say, no, you can't have the we won't reimburse you for the medicine that helps you. And we'll do what Dr. Brady says, either take a medicine that's costly, bad, you know, bad consequences and doesn't help you, or suck it up and take the pain, which, as the appellate division said,
Mr. Silver, with respect to 844, and I'm very glad that Justice Levecchia had it, it seems that a reasonable construction of that particular provision is to cover schedules other than Schedule One, because otherwise physicians would be able to write prescriptions for cocaine and heroin. So it does not seem as though that provision was meant to override Schedule One for the reasons that Justice Levecchia said, because Schedule One drugs are, we're told, as a matter of law, have no health related benefits. Do you agree?
I'd be really ready to try that case, Justice. Okay. I think in terms of the rule of lenity, I'd have a shot. Would I win? I really don't know.
I'd pass
the straight face test. Actually, that's really the point here, that if you pass the straight face test, that's significant.
You're here as a friend of the court. Help us on the question of whether it's appropriate to consider practicality when you're doing a question about conflicts preemption, because that takes you away from asking, is it impossible to comply with both statutes at the same time? And instead the focus then becomes, what will the prosecutor do? How will the prosecutor exercise his or her discretion? Which might lead to a situation where in a state like New Jersey, there's little chance of a prosecution, but in a different state with exactly identically worded statutes, you could end up with preemption. Does that make sense?
I mean, that is the question. I mean, you put right in the heart of the bullseye, that's the question. Are we gonna do form or are we gonna do reality? Are we gonna help people? It seems to me that the policy here between making the reimbursement for cannabis available to people, it seems to me means that we should affirm the appellate division if we can do so with integrity. From a policy standpoint, a reversal here is not good for anybody. And the question is it compelled by the statute? And that's the point to make.
Mr. Silver, would you agree with, just in general, that the American history is full of situations where something that was prosecuted in one decade was not prosecuted the next, and vice versa? That laws change, but also prosecutorial discretion sometimes changes abruptly with the election of a particular president or the appointment of a particular U.S. attorney.
You mean in this case, for example, that the vice president-elect is the sponsor of the bill to remove?
Well, I'm not asking you to get into politics.
But
all I'm saying is that prosecutorial discretion and something being a particular act or omission being prosecuted or not can change with time, and it can change abruptly with time. Is that true?
But we have enough examples of that. That's true. I've won cases in this very court that have changed the law. That's obviously true. I'm not sure where that takes us, though, unless we're going to say that because there is a possibility, let me say for Justice Alvin, let's say a probability, that there is a conflict between the possession of small amounts of cannabis in the federal statute and this statute, that you could find a conflict if you want to. It's in a case where there's no chance of there ever being a prosecution. There's never been one in, since 1996. So the issue that the chief raises is the practical real world application, or the fact that there are two statutes that could probably be in conflict.
So part of the question that I'm asking, though, focuses on whether analytically it's appropriate to consider practicality when you're doing
an analysis of conflict preemption, because then that turns on how the prosecutor exercises
his or her discretion.
We get back to the language in the cases, which talks about hypothetical or probable. And so it seems to me that in that kind of a situation, you're opening the door to practicality where it's as stark and dramatic as it is here. And it really is as stark and dramatic as anything I've seen. I mean, we know sitting here, there's no chance that anybody's going to be prosecuted in the situation where a employer or an insurance company reimburses a small amount of money for a small amount of cannabis that's doing that the professionals say does some good for the patient.
Mr. Silver, are you aware of any lawsuits filed anywhere in the United States with respect to medical marijuana or recreational marijuana to enjoin the enforcement of state laws?
Oh, yes. I mean, there've been a bunch of them that have all failed. I think the last one was in the Southern District of New York, Washington, I think was the name of the case. I say there've been maybe 1,000 of those cases. I mean, they happen all the time. Okay.
So we know, so I'm asking that question.
Yeah. And they've never won. They always failed. That's okay. True.
Okay.
I, by the way, just for prediction, I think that's going to end. But I think it's going to end legislatively. And truthfully, if we're talking about the memos and we're talking about the session memo and stuff, the House Judiciary Committee sent the Moore Act to the floor, which it may be voted on in the House this week. And then it goes to the Senate, where the New Jersey senator and the vice president-elect are sponsors of the bill. So, I'm not predicting politically, but certainly in the wit. Let's put it this way. I don't think there's anybody who thinks the federal prohibition is going to endure the next 4 years, whether it goes in the next month or 5 months or a year, who knows? But, it's going.
Any other questions?
Anything you'd like to add, Mr. Silver?
No, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. Mr. Gitterman, did you want to offer a brief rebuttal? Have to unmute yourself.
Yeah. Yes, please. Thank you. I just want to read from page 20 of the Massachusetts decision. I think there's some language in the Massachusetts decision that is very pertinent to our case today. As the statute recognizes, and obviously this is talking about the Massachusetts decision, and I'm reading from page 20, as the statute recognizes, requiring companies that ensure the health of medical marijuana patients to pay for their marijuana usage raises the stakes much higher. If insurers were required to make such payments, the size and scope of the legalization of medical marijuana would be substantially expanded, raising concerns about federal enforcement and preemption. First, unlike the patients and doctors covered by the act, insurance companies would not be participating in patients' use of a federally prescribed substance voluntarily. It is one thing to voluntarily assume, I'm on page 21 now, it is one thing to voluntarily assume a risk of federal prosecution. It is another to involuntarily have such a risk imposed upon you. As discussed super, possession and distribution of marijuana remain federally illegal, as does aiding or abetting such possession or distribution. It is not unreasonable, given the current hazy regulatory environment and shifting winds of federal enforcement, for insurance companies to fear that paying for a claimant's marijuana could expose them to potential criminal prosecution. Further, insurance companies are typically involved in interstate commerce, thereby raising federal regulators' concerns. Requiring interstate insurers to participate, in this case, in the Massachusetts medical marijuana scheme, would extend the reach of the Massachusetts Act well beyond the Commonwealth's borders. Reimbursement may also increase usage and the amounts of money at stake, thereby further expanding the scope of the statute and thus federal concerns. By providing that the Act does not require insurers to reimburse medical marijuana expenses, the reimbursement limitation provision protects third parties from being compelled to pay for the use of a federally prescribed substance. Again, Chief Justice Ravner asked Mr. Matthews a very important question, and that is paying up front. Is that any different if you pay up front versus paying after? And Mr. Matthews says that is different. It's clearly different. I don't think it is. I think whether you pay up front or you reimburse, you're still knowingly paying for marijuana. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for the helpful arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.